Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Do you know who the best-selling poet in the United States is? It's not Robert Frost. It's not Maya Angelou. It's not T.S. Eliot, and no, it's not a trick question. The answer is not Bob Dylan. It's Rumi. Yes, the 12th century Persian mystic Jalaluddin Rumi is the best-selling poet in the U.S. Meanwhile, back in Iran, poetry by Rumi and the other great Persian poets is the basis for most of their classical music. We'll get a chance to hear some music from the Persian classical tradition when singer Bahar Movahed joins us. She'll explain why she left Iran and how women are restricted from having music careers there. Also, we wanted to bring in one of the stars of the Broadway musical Annie, but we were told he wouldn't talk to us and might actually poop on the floor. So we got his trainer, Bill Berlone, instead. He'll tell us about the challenge of preparing dogs and other animals to appear on stage. Of course, it can also be challenging to prepare people to appear on the Broadway stage, especially little people.
And I will wake up when the sun comes up, and I will watch cartoons until my eyes go square, and I won't care because I'll be all grown up.
Matilda is Broadway's newest import from the UK, where it won a record-breaking 7 Olivier Awards. That's their version of the Tonys, including one for Tim Minchin, who wrote the lyrics and the music, and one for what Tim called the Little Twerps, the kids who play Matilda and her long-suffering classmates. Well, Matilda's here in New York, and the New York Times chief theater critic Ben Brantley is joining us on the line to tell us about it. Ben, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much.
The single line that leaps off the page to me in your review of Matilda is this one: the most satisfying and subversive musical ever to come out of Britain. That is high praise. What makes Matilda subversive, first of all?
Well, it's, you expect it to be just a kind of nice children's musical. It turns out to have quite a bit of darkness in it, and I think better than any stage show I've ever seen, it addresses the fears that we all have in childhood. There are lines about the monster under the bed, but also particularly the anxiety that comes with going to school and feeling powerless before a real monster of a teacher, in this case, Miss Trunchbull. But also it's a fight for literacy, this show. It's about the importance of words and stories and putting them together as a defense against the horrors of childhood and a way of making sense of a confusing world.
So the basic story is it's a book originally by Roald Dahl, who gave us James and the Giant Peach and so many others. And it's the story of a 5-year-old girl named Matilda Wormwood. You've already mentioned the teacher, Ms. Trunchbull. I mean, these are very Dickensian names.
And there is, that's a good point. There is a Dickensian empathy for the vulnerability of children, with the vulnerability of children, and the sense of oppression that, you know, Matilda isn't, you know, working in a shoe blacking factory.
Right.
She's not an orphan or an urchin, although she'd probably be happier if she were an orphan. She has horrible parents who believe in the virtues of being loud, think books are the worst thing that a child could pick up, and really have no interest in her. So she develops this great interior life.
We're speaking with Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic for the New York Times, about Matilda, which has opened on Broadway at the Schubert Theater for an open-ended run. This is a little bit of the original London cast recording of the song Naughty.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. So they say the subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way in a innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met. That love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of the hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story.
That's just a little bit from Tim Minchin's score to the Broadway musical Matilda, based on the Roald Dahl novel. That's a bit from the original London cast recording. Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic for the New York Times, with a rave review of it in the Times and on the line with us. And you do mention that the kids have been working on their accents for the American version. They're not British, I take it.
No, I think most of them are not. I mean, they're, for all I know, I mean, there may be some binationals among them, but they do the English accents very well, better, I think, than many adults do. There's a little problem with diction, I think, sometimes. You can't always hear the lyrics, which are terrific. I love that song, Naughty. Jack and Jill didn't stand a chance because they were written that way. I love that perception.
Yeah. We've actually heard that song before because I guess it was the Brit Awards last year where the cast came out and did that song, and I remember being actually quite taken with it. Not the sort of thing I would normally find myself kind of humming along to, but Tim Minchin, I mean, this is a guy who's, this is a big step up for him, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. He was principally known for satiric songs and stand-up acts. And there are elements of satire, certainly, in this show against television, the sort of dancing with the stars kind of fascination with gaudiness and celebrity. But there's real heart in it, too, which I would not have predicted on his work before. A song like When I Grow Up is so wistful and touching, and the songs written for Miss Honey, the school young school teacher who's Matilda's mentor, are really classic, with a little subversive touch, Broadway ballads of loneliness and sort of a hunger for love. So he came up aces with this.
Well, your colleague Patrick Healy there at the Times spoke with Tim Minchin about the music, and here's a little bit from the video that's on the New York Times website.
What Dahl manages is to somehow have kids thrown around by their hair, have kids, you know, beaten and shouted at and locked in cellars and denied an education and, you know, charged for their food. But he seems to manage to do it with this incredibly light touch, you know. And so the headmistress threw the girl by the hair out the window. The next day, you know, there's no sort of... And then in the hospital.
So the thing that strikes me, Ben, about this Roald Dahl story, as you've described it, and even the little bit we hear from Tim Minchin there, is he wrote this way before there was such a thing as reality TV, the internet. I mean, it's really kind of prescient, in a sense, to hear this kind of storytelling about storytelling today.
Yes, it is. Although I think it's probably a more benign self-consciousness that Matilda has as the author of her own life. She's not trying to translate it into big ratings and then wind up, and I mean, if she did, she'd wind up, you know, a drug-addicted wreck at 15. But there is an it's remarkable how relevant its satirical touch is and what Dahl gave it, including the opening number, which is Miracle, in which all the parents, or in the kids too, I'm a miracle, I'm the most special person in the world. It's that whole kind of cult of inculcating self-esteem in kids and saying you're the best thing there is. And then of course we meet Matilda, who gets none of that from her parents.
My mommy says I'm a miracle.
My daddy says I'm a special little guy.
I am a princess.
And I am a prince.
Mom says I'm an angel sent down from the sky.
My daddy says I'm a special little soldier. No one is as handsome, strong as me. It's true he indulges my tendency to bulge, but I'm his little soldier. Hop, two, four, three.
My mummy says I'm a miracle.
So we're talking about the musical Matilda on Broadway now, with music and lyrics by Tim Minchin, book by Dennis Kelly, and it's based on this Roald Dahl novel. It's at the Schubert Theater, an open-ended run. Who stood out for you, Ben, in the Broadway cast?
Well, Bertie Carvel, a man, plays Miss Trunchbull, known as the Trunchbull, a great villainess. I mean, for me, up there with Cruella de Vil from 101 Dalmatians. Mm-hmm. And it's a grotesque performance, but it's also a subtle performance. He has a way of, when Miss Trunchbull anticipates throwing the kids into Chokey, the horrible dungeon where they, you know, come out ashen and never the same, she just kind of wriggles her fingers in the air. I think I said in the review, like a mortician about to skin a corpse. There's something so ominous and strange and neurotic about her at the same time. She's the hammer-throwing champion of Great Britain and demonstrates her prowess by picking up a little girl by the pigtails and flinging her into the air, or that's the illusion we get anyway. She's a marvelous creation, and like everything in the musical, Carvel's performance, it's not wild. That's the incredible thing. It's not like, oh, I'm going to get you all. There's this kind of restrained, sinister aspect to it that gets under your skin much more effectively.
She sings a song called The Hammer, and again, as Ben Brantley just said, she was in her past life the hammer thrower, the hammer being not a literal hammer and nail, but the Olympic thing, the thing you hold on, you swing around, and you toss it. So this is Bertie Carvel in the role of Ms. Trunchbull in the musical Matilda.
As I stepped up to the circle, did I change my plan? What? As I chalked up my palms, did I wave my hands? I did not. As I started my spin, did I look at the view? Did I drift off and dream for a minute or two? Do you think I faltered or amended my rotation? Do you think I altered my intended elevation? As the hammer took off, did I change my grunt? From the grunt I had practiced for many a month. Not a jot, not a dot, did I stray from the plot. Not a detail of my throw was adjusted or forgotten. Not even when the hammer left my hands and sailed up above the stands. Did I let myself go? No, 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 no. If you want to throw the hammer for your country.
Ben Brantley, what a creepy little number that is.
Isn't that a great number? I love it going into that little kind of music hall lilt. If you want to throw the hammer.
So Bertie Carvel, is he a holdover from the original London cast?
He and Lauren Ward, who plays Miss Honey, the sympathetic teacher, are the only two that I know of who came over from, or the only ones that I saw in the London cast. And he's essential. Lauren Ward's very good, too, but I can't imagine anyone else doing the Trunchbull. It's a singular performance.
So is it able to be both dark and funny at the same time?
Remarkably, yeah, and it's a hard line to walk, but in a way that the Book of Mormon, for example, is both a satire of the conventional Broadway musical and a celebration of it.
Mm-hmm.
Matilda manages to be both sort of solemn and fearful, but also very witty. I think it would actually provide great catharsis for kids who are so scared of everything, often whether they admit it or not.
So for the proverbial kids of all ages, or will kids who are too young be a little too scared by this?
I don't know. I think you're taken out of the dark, as you are in classic children's entertainments like the Wizard of Oz or Oliver the Musical. I mean, we go into some pretty sinister places, but you never doubt that Matilda will triumph.
All right. Well, Matilda is currently triumphing on Broadway at the Schubert Theater in an open-ended run with music and lyrics by Tim Minchin, book by Dennis Kelly, based on the novel by Roald Dahl. We've been speaking with Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic for the New York Times. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. Now, speaking of Broadway musicals, when my producers first told me that our next guest has worked with Cats on stage, I thought they were talking about the musical Cats.
Midnight, not a sound from the pavement. Has the moon lost her memory? She is smiling.
smiling alone.
But for Bill Berlone, working with cats on stage means working with actual felines, and more often, dogs, or even rats and birds and all sorts of other creatures. Bill is an animal trainer for Broadway, television, and film, and in fact, two of his dogs are currently working in the 35th anniversary production of Annie on Broadway. Bill Berlone joins me here in the studio, and alone, Bill. What, no animals?
I have one in my case, actually. Let me just let them out.
Now, you originally set out to be in the theater, but not as an animal trainer, right?
No, as an actor. But those were teenage dreams. Those were high school dreams where, you know, when I graduated high school, I wanted to be an actor. And instead of spending my summers at the shore having fun, I apprenticed at a theater called the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut as a technical apprentice so that I could start working with professionals before I started going to NYU. And, the second season there, they did a show that had an animal in it. And when they found out how much it cost to have a professional trainer came down, they went to the paid staff members and all the prop guys threatened to quit if they had to train the dog, so the producer needed a sucker. And I was called in his office, all of 19 years old. And
the wide-eyed intern?
The wide-eyed intern, and he offered me my equity card and a part in one of the shows there. And I thought, my goodness, you know, he saw my acting ability by the way I built scenery. And he said, all you have to do, kid, is find and train a dog for no money, which is what I did. I went to a shelter and got a dog, and you know, that was the original production of Annie, and I found the original Sandy, and that's where my career began.
Casting the character. Yeah. Can we use – do you use character?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
The character of Sandy, which is a dog.
Yeah.
So that has become, I guess – that must be among animal trainers who specialize in the theater. Annie must be one of the go-to productions.
It is actually – I'm the only trainer in theater who does it, so I guess I'm – only go-to guy, really. But Annie marked the turning point in theater in that prior to Annie, no animal had ever played a character.
Mm-hmm.
Because anybody who thought they can get an animal to do the same thing every week, eight times, you know, a week in front of a live audience is crazy. But when you're 19 years old, you know, you can do anything. So, you know, when I came along and sort of developed this technique to get animals to play characters, Broadway then stood up and went, wait a minute, if he did it with that, well, he could do it with other projects.
Yeah. So what was that technique that you developed?
I grew up on a farm as an only child, so my companions, my brothers and sisters growing up, were animals. So I don't look at animals as lesser beings. I look at them as companions, and I treat them with the same respect I treat humans. So I would never force you to do anything. So, but if I had to get you to do something, I would create a situation and a motivation for you to do it. And
if you gave me a treat, I would probably do it.
Yeah. I mean, humans prefer money, but, you know. And so my approach to animal training is positive reinforcement. It's creating a situation where they want to perform as opposed to forcing them to perform, which mm-hmm. is the prevailing thought with humans and animals.
All right. Question that just occurred mm-hmm. to me since you mentioned money. Who gets paid here?
I do. I've put the paycheck down many times, and all it's done is gotten slobbered on. So put down some food, and they go for it. So we keep the money. They get the food.
So so you started this all with the character of Sandy, the
yep.
dog in the musical Annie. Where did you get that original dog?
Well, part of the deal was the producer said I had to do it for little or no money, and he gave me $35. Now, this is the summer of 1976, to find, train, and feed the dog for the entire summer, $35.
Mm.
So someone said they had cheap dogs at the animal shelter. So I took a Polaroid camera to go casting one day. And up until that point in my very young life, I'd never been to an animal shelter. And I remember being profoundly moved. I really didn't understand that people abandon animals. So I ended up at the Connecticut Humane Society, and Sandy was there. So, you know, I went back to the theater, and I only had $3. And so I went back to the theater, borrowed another $4, and adopted this dog. So that's where we got the original Sandy. And since then, my mission has been to – every animal I train is a rescue animal, and, you know, we promote animal welfare wherever mm-hmm. we can.
Now, how long did that dog play Sandy?
He played it for 8 years. He did the entire Broadway run and then continued doing, like, special guest appearances until, you know, well into his 12, 13 years old.
So he was part of the original cast of the 1977 Broadway production.
Correct.
Of Annie. Although we don't hear much of him in this excerpt, but he's there.
It's a hard knock life.
That's from the 1977 original Broadway cast recording of Annie and the song Hard Knock Life. Sandy the dog in that original production was trained by Bill Berlone, who is an animal trainer for stage and film and author of the book Broadway Tales, that's T-A-I-L-S, heartfelt stories of rescued dogs who became showbiz superstars. Is most of your work on stage in musicals?
Yes. I would say 60% musicals, 40% plays.
Is it easier or are there more complications trying to train an animal to respond to music and musical cues?
It has little to do with the music except its extraneous noise. So whenever there's an orchestra involved, you know, we're very careful. Where's the timpani? Where's the bass? Because the sound hurts their ears. So that's that's the only difference. They don't react to the music for musical cues, just to, you know, they're there when it's going.
Right. So what kind of cues do they react to?
Hand signals.
Uh-huh.
And what's different about what I do as well, most trainers handle their dog. But in my case, I'm in the wings. I'm 30 feet away, so the dog has to respond to the actors on stage. So we train the actors to become trainers, and they're giving all the commands. I'm just in the wing supervising.
I had read somewhere about a production, I think it was the Christmas Story that they do at Radio City, where they changed a musical cue and the donkeys were responding to the music thinking it was time for them to leave the stage. Does that sound like it would even be possible that animals would be so attuned to the music that they would be thrown off by a change in it?
Well, you're calling it music. To them, it's noise in the surroundings.
Right.
So, you know, in the same way they would hear thunder and go for cover, you know, if there is a sound which to them means we leave now and they hear that sound, they would, and it's been repetitive, they probably would do that, yeah.
So when your dog is out on stage during Annie, and this is now the 35th anniversary production, so you've seen this show, I'm guessing. Do it in your sleep.
Yeah.
Are you there every night?
Well, usually I am. I set up the show, get it going, and then I put one of my trainers in so that I can move on to the next project. But they live and are with a trainer 24 hours a day, making sure they're happy, healthy, and, you know, ready to do the show.
So where do they live when they're not working?
We have a 90-acre farm up in central Connecticut, a retirement home for unemployed acting dogs and cats. So in between gigs, they come home.
So these are your animals?
Yeah, we own 23 dogs who are in various stages of their performing career, you know, in training, working, retired. Oh. So,
and you said cats. Mm-hmm. Now, cats have been in the news, you know, the Breakfast at Tiffany's tiff where the understudy cat was fired because he's a cat. Well. When you put him on stage, he acts like a cat. Can you train a cat?
Yes. And I'm so glad I didn't work on that show. you know, they came in with so little time to prepare. And I've trained cats for shows like Alice in Wonderland and The Lieutenant of Inishmore. And, you know, you need 6 months to find and motivate the right cat. You know, you don't come in and give cat direction. The cat gives you direction. So, you know, in that particular production, I knew with only a month of preparation that it would be a miracle if they got the cat to do the behaviors they needed.
Mm-hmm. So now there's an upcoming musical. Your wife bought the theatrical rights to Because of Winn-Dixie, which people will know perhaps the film, but it was originally, of course, a book. Is this going to be the first theatrical production where you can be in complete control of how the animals are? First of all, what animals are involved there?
Because of Winn-Dixie, it's about a young girl and her father and the mom has run away. He's a preacher. And they move from town to town aimlessly, and they come to a town, and she finds and adopts a giant dog, and she calls it Winn-Dixie. And the dog ends up changing their lives and making it better. So we have two Irish wolfhounds that we're training to play the role of Winn-Dixie.
Now, is this like when you have a baby on a sitcom and you have to have twins because you need to swap them out, or do they do different nights and one does the whole show? How does that work?
A little bit of both. You know, when we did Annie, when you think of how popular Sandy is, the dog is only on stage 6.5 minutes, and it's created this aura about it. When we do The Wizard of Oz, in which the dog is on stage in every scene with Dorothy, that would exhaust one dog. So we have two dogs who we double out as in the same role. So we're using that model for Winn-Dixie, because Winn-Dixie will be on stage every performance. So in this case, we will, for the first production, we have two dogs playing the same role. And then if we move forward, we'll probably need dogs to then back them up in case they become ill.
And this will be a musical.
It'll be a musical.
Duncan Sheik is writing the music.
And Nell Benjamin, who worked with us on Legally Bond, is doing books and lyrics. And very wonderful director John Tartaglia, who's an actor, puppeteer. Mm. I've worked with him on Sesame Street. He had his own TV show. But, you know, he's just brilliant in terms of taking inanimate objects and making them come alive for audiences.
So when will we get to see Because of Winn-Dixie?
Well, after 10 years of beating the boards, we're having a world premiere at the Arkansas Repertory Theater in Little Rock, Arkansas, this December. And hopefully from there, you know, people will be inspired to then ask us to move to another venue.
All right. Well, we have gotten permission to give our listeners a look ahead at one of Duncan Sheik's songs written for Bill Berlone's upcoming musical adaptation of Because of Winn-Dixie. Bill Berlone is an animal trainer for stage and film. Two of his dogs are currently working on the 35th anniversary production of Annie on Broadway, now at the Palace Theater. And Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is Soundcheck.
I don't want to sleep now, because who knows? Eyes close, you doze, and something goes. Thought I could catch things before they fell. I'd know it would show. I thought I could tell you weren't happy. Why didn't you say? I never saw you go away. I had a dream. To stay awake, more cups of coffee to get me through. Can't bear to sleep and dream of you.
That's an exclusive sneak peek at a new song by singer-songwriter Duncan Sheik, written for the upcoming musical adaptation of the book Because of Winn-Dixie. Coming up, the talented Iranian singer Bahar Movahed stops by our studio, and we'll hear from a few of you who called in to tell us about the music your parents raised you on. This is Soundcheck. Earlier this week, we did a show about the music that your parents chose for you to listen to when you were a little kid, before you were old enough to pick your own stuff. And we heard from a lot of you about the music that your parents raised you on, and I gotta say, most of it was pretty positive. Downright adorable, in fact. Like this first message from Erin in Brooklyn.
I just had to call when you're talking about music that your parents played for you, because I have a great story. My dad loves music, and he had a 45 jukebox that was a wedding gift from my mom. And he rigged it up so he didn't have to put any coins in it to play it, and he would basically fill it with seasonal music for us. So Halloween songs at Halloween and Christmas songs at Christmas, and then, you know, in off times, just like music he thought we would like on these 45 records. And we could just go and press the buttons and hear whatever song we wanted to hear and play with this giant jukebox that he would lovingly fill with specially catered music for us.
Wow, Erin, your dad wins the Musical Parent of the Year Award, maybe even for the century. Anyone else want to chime in about how great their dad is?
Hi, this is Travis from Bayside, New York. I wanted to talk about my dad, actually. When I was a little kid growing up, he made me a little album, well, little tape cassettes called Travi Tunes, which were a mashup of all the music my dad listened to and all the music my mom listened to and a little bit of modern day stuff. So I had Talking Heads on the list, at the same time Luther Vandross and Teddy Prendergast. with some Elvis Costello thrown in. A couple of 90s jock jams were also on it. So it was an interesting mix, and it actually shaped a lot of my musical taste from today.
So there you have it, a specially programmed jukebox and Travi tunes. Kids these days, they really have it all. Let's hear from someone who grew up back in the day, when things were tough and kids had to walk uphill both ways to school.
Hi, my name is Martha. Hi, John. My parents got me in 1936, so my dad loved jazz. And so we sat in the dark at night listening to his jazz records. We didn't have TV that time, so we listened to records. And then as time went on, we gradually listened to swing, and then gradually Frank Sinatra and so forth. So that's what I listened to and loved. Thanks.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I want to go play hide and seek. I want to go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. You and I are just like a couple of tots running across a meadow, picking up lots of forget-me-nots.
All right, that sounds pretty nice, too. Well, thanks to all of you who've called in so far to tell us about the music your parents picked out for you. If you're a parent now, tell us about the music you're choosing for your kids. You can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Singer Bahar Movahed grew up in Iran, studying the rich tradition of Persian classical music. But coming from a partly Kurdish family, she also found herself drawn to the music of the Kurds, as in this album called Goblet of Eternal Light. But as a woman, she found her opportunities to make music in Iran were severely restricted. So she moved to L.A. 3 years ago and joins us here in our New York studio with a trio to perform on Soundcheck. Here is Bahar Movahed with a song called Nahavand Kabir.
I know. sarà di linee tanno dir tan dir tannani tanno sarà di linee dillara dillar lar dara tannani tanno dillara dillar lar dara tannani tanno tannan nadara dilline bo salome madone chashma hey 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 hey
bit of Persian classical music here in the Soundcheck studio. Nahavand Kabir, played by Navid Kandalusi on the kamancha, the Persian fiddle. Ali Samadpour playing the tar, which is one of the Persian lutes. And the vocalist is Bahar Movahed, joining me at the microphone. Bahar, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much. I'm so honored to be on your show.
So your recording that we heard a little bit of at the beginning with Ali Akbar Moradi is of Kurdish music, but the songs you're doing today are from the great Persian classical tradition. Which tradition did you grow up with?
Oh, well, both, kind of both of them. I speak in Farsi, mm-hmm. but my father is from a Kurdish city, and pretty much familiar with Kurdish culture. And so I grew up in a way that I got familiar with both cultures, mm-hmm. Persian culture and
so
Kurdish culture.
Is Kurdish unity and Kurdish rights, is that kind of a theme in some of your work?
You know, the Goblet of Eternal Light, its focus is on kind of an artistic or musical unification of different Kurdish tribes.
So wherever they live.
Yeah, with the hope that to bring them all together in the real life.
Now, here you are, Bahar, you know, performing on the radio. How hard would this be for you to do if you were still living in Iran?
This is a little difficult to describe. You know, women are struggling with many restrictions in Iran. And but what I prefer to say is that this is an opportunity that is given to me here, that I can freely pursue my vocal career here. But
yeah,
you know,
I sense you being careful answering, answering the question.
You know, things change a lot in Iran, and who knows?
Things changed a lot a generation ago because, I mean, I've heard recordings of Persian classical singers, male and female, together, clearly in, on the same stage or in the same studio, and that changed around the 1979, 1980, at the time of the revolution.
Yeah, yeah. And right after the revolution, there was no music at all. And so things changed, and the artists and musicians found the chance to perform. But women are still prohibited to perform as a solo singer or solo vocalist in Iran. But they can perform only for a female audience. But this limits their work very much,
of course,
and they can't still produce CDs and publish it into the market.
All right. Well, so you moved to L.A. a couple of years ago. There is obviously a large Iranian community in L.A. And the songs that you're doing for us today come, again, from the Persian tradition. Bahar Movahed, the vocalist, performing with us here in the studio. Her most recent album with Ali Akbar Moradi is a collaborative effort called Goblet of Eternal Light. It is out now. The song is called Ataşe Dil, The Fire Within.
Simon Mahro Monfair جمال خود بنما زیرنگ و بوید خجل نما گل را رو در طرف چمن بین بنشست چون من دل خون بس غمه یاری غم چه دهن گل در بخشند چهره ما بنده غم چه
song is called Attaché d'Elle, The Fire Within, a sort of contemporary bit of Persian classical music sung once again by Bahar Movahed with Ali Samadpour on the tar, the plucked string instrument, and Navid Kandalusi playing the kamanche, the bowed string instrument. Bahar, it's really been a pleasure meeting you and having you perform for us here in the studio. Thank you so much for being
with
us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having us.
This is Soundcheck. Up next, we take a listen to this week's Check Ahead from slide guitarist and songwriter Luke Winslow King, and we'll hear a bit about the album from the artist himself. This is Soundcheck. This week's Check Ahead comes to us from the slide guitarist and songwriter Luke Winslow King. The Coming Tide is the name of his third studio album. It comes out on April 23rd, but we're streaming it in its entirety on our website right now. Here's Soundcheck producer Greta Cohn with more of the story.
Luke Winslow King has a true cross-pollinated sound. It's a sound he's been honing for as long as he can remember.
I grew up hearing Bob Dylan and James Taylor tunes around the campfire, and I was always into jazz. I played in jazz band and played a lot of Jimi Hendrix and like Led Zeppelin and Muddy Waters stuff in high school. Played in a few like rock and roll cover bands. Studied jazz guitar and was learning classical music, arranging and music theory and stuff like that. I've just, you know, always been interested in a lot of different things, and I really just try to find myself within all those different kinds of music.
God made me sing, oh, you and me, babe. Me and you.
He's especially studied the sound of New Orleans, where he's lived for the last decade. He studied its brass bands and its Delta blues. But Luke, who's originally from Michigan, didn't choose New Orleans. He was traveling through more than 10 years ago when the city chose him. Well, it chose his car, leaving him stranded.
It was a big like 80s style GMC Suburban, and it was full of accordions, guitars, keyboards, CDs, you know, everything a folk band would bring on the road with them. And we parked it there overnight, and we came back, and we just saw broken glass on the sidewalk, and we're just kind of shocked, sat there dumbfounded for a few minutes trying to figure out where the car could be. We lost a lot of our instruments that we kind of grew up playing on, and that was kind of sad, but I feel like I was able to, you know, pay my dues.
So he stayed, no hard feelings, and over the last decade, he's busked, recorded with blues masters, and built up his own band. This new record, called The Coming Tide, features singer and washboard player Esther Rose. It's a kind of French Quarter meets gospel revival meets AM radio. Here's the title track.
You better come inside for the coming tide. You better come inside
for the coming tide.
Oh, you better come inside for the fall of the coming tide. Better come inside for the coming tide.
I've been playing a lot of traditional music, and I was just like, you know, sitting on the porch playing guitar one day, and it all kind of came to me all at once. Like, when I started writing it down, the verses just kind of flowed right out. I guess it has some kind of, like, spiritual themes kind of underlying, but it's also a little bit more like a secularized gospel song. You know, get all your loose ends tied up before the big event. Take heed.
You better fall in line
for the coming tide.
You better fall in line
for the coming tide.
Oh, you better fall in line for the fall of the coming tide. Better fall in line for the coming tide.
The city of New Orleans has certainly seen its share of shifting tides, and that includes the changing face of one street in particular, Rampart Street. Here's Luke Winslow King and his band reinterpreting a 1920s Ida Cox song called I've Got the Blues for Rampart Street.
Rampart Street in New Orleans town, known to everyone 4 miles around for Creole music.
It's about celebrating all the old cabarets and brothels that used to be in Storyville in the red light district of New Orleans about 100 years ago. And it's great. It lists through some of the clubs that used to be on the street. And it's, you know, I want to go back to Tom Anderson's cafe. I want to hear those jazz bands play.
I want to go down to Tom Anderson's cafe. I want to hear those jazz bands play.
It's like longing about the old days of Storyville and how jazz used to be so alive and thriving. And I guess we see that a little bit in our community today, how, you know, people think New Orleans is the best place in all the land, is another lyric from the song, and just how people feel like they really long to come back here and enjoy the music just being alive in all these clubs down the street.
But probably the most surprising moment on the record is the band's take on a song that was a hit for George Harrison in 1987. I've Got My Mind Set on You is all casual swagger and slide guitar, and it really creeps up on you in the way that only a good blues song can do.
We've got our mind set on Luke Winslow King in this week's Check Ahead. That was producer Greta Cohn with slide guitarist Luke Winslow King, and you can visit soundcheck.org to hear his upcoming record, The Coming Tide, in its entirety. Luke and his band will also be playing a few shows in town later this month, and you can find out more about that at soundcheck.org as well. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., visit soundcheck.org to stream the band Ivan and Alyosha taping a live session in our studio. They released their first full-length album earlier this year. We'll talk with them about why it took so darn long, and we'll hear them play live.
Tomorrow night at 9, this Saturday marks the unofficial holiday known as Record Store Day. It's become an international celebration of music and independent record stores. And now that it's been around for a couple of years, we think it's due for a soundcheck smackdown debate. Tune in to hear Joe Levy of Billboard and Ben Greenman of The New Yorker duke it out in our studio. Plus, guitarist William Tyler joins us to play songs off of his third LP, Impossible Truth. And we talk about some noteworthy new releases. And that'll do it for the program today. See you back here tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.